As the title suggests, I'm going to be looking at the post-war hospital crisis in France and England, specifically in Leeds and Lille, in that 10 years following the First World War. I will do the usual thing. This is very much work in progress in the sense that I just began doing some of the research on this last autumn, really, and so kind of just working through some of the ideas at this point. What I'm going to do today is try and set some context, both historiographical and in terms of the places. I'm very interested in place and how places influence the kind of services and the kind of behaviors which you see. I shall then move on to look at the war and the crisis which did occur in these two towns, how they were different, and then the responses from the two different perspectives in terms of how they dealt with the crises. And then I'm going to attempt a few bigger ideas about maybe where France and England diverge in this interwar period in terms of how they organize and develop their health services, and particularly their hospital services, and how we then move on to the systems which both countries create in the 1940s. In the case of Britain, there is now quite a widely developed historiography on the history of the 20th century hospital before the NHS. It's moved away from its more Whiggish accounts of people like Abel Smith and Webster that see a kind of inevitability to the NHS. And it's focused especially on finance, accountability, and control issues. The work of Martin Gorski, John Moen, Steve Cherry, and to a lesser extent myself, have kind of looked at those very much those issues. Yeah, in much of the writing, there's still a bit of an emphasis on that inevitability of the NHS. I mean, if you look at Martin Gorski's essay on 60 years of the NHS, published a couple of years ago, there is still a sort of sense in which it is the only answer. It is the only way in which you can develop a universalist, free at the point of delivery service. Although someone, Nick Hayes, Nottingham Trent, is currently working on looking at how popular was the idea of a nationalized national health service in the 1940s, and hopefully we might see some of that work coming out fairly soon. On the other hand, the history of hospitals in France, particularly in the 20th century, is still very limited. There's not been much development. There are few books, and there are very few books on modern hospitals. There is a Société Française d'Histoire des Hôpitaux, which provides a few features on modern hospitals, but mostly it's interested in the early modern period and those kind of old hospice-type traditions. What there is, as with much French history, the focus has been on the state response, especially on the emergence of a national welfare state. For example, the recent work by Dutton on the system particularly looks at Lorraine and contrasts it with the kind of German model. And there's been a focus on the action of the national government, focusing on the emphasis on pronatalist policies in the 1920s and 30s, or really from the late 19th century onwards. So the pronatalist policies of the Third Republic have been dominating French health history, with a look at mental health services, psychiatry and the role of the doctors. They're very much interested in professionalisation, pronatalism, but much, much less in the hospital in the way that we've seen in Britain in recent years. The main exception to this has been Timothy Smith's book, which is on the welfare state, but it does at least have a full fully addresses the hospital system, focuses on Lyon in the Third Republic period, and demonstrates a move from a local Catholic voluntarist control to a state response to the development of welfare systems from central government, which broke the hold of those local Catholic elites. Once again, you see a slightly sort of inevitabilist argument in this, that the pre-state system is weak, it's patchy, and it doesn't provide a full service in a way that a state system does. I'm going to use a comparison to try and understand, firstly, short-term responses to the post-war financial crisis, which these both systems experienced, and then tentatively consider a longer-term outcomes of the organization of hospitals between the wars. So Leeds, I didn't bother with a map because I thought you might know where it was. But it's an industrial commercial center in northern England. It was one of the kind of key towns of the Industrial Revolution, initially built on textiles, but then there's a move in the second half of the 19th century and into the 20th century, firstly to ready-made clothing north of the river and to engineering south of the river. So you see it much more as a kind of modern, developing certainly as a commercial city as well. Just to give a little bit of background in case you don't know this bit, hospitals in England in this period up until 1929 were split between three providers. The voluntary sector, which were hospitals provided by donations, by subscriptions, and by kind of various kinds of voluntary action. The doctors provided their services for free, and usually those people admitted were the respectable sick poor. There was then a poor law system, which developed patchily. So this is a kind of a residual system for the non-respectable poor or the unrespectable poor or those who couldn't in other ways gain access to the voluntary hospitals, often the chronically sick, the elderly, groups like that who ended up in the poor law infirmaries. Over the later 19th century and into the 20th century, particularly in towns, poor law infirmaries became much better. They weren't just kind of bastilles. But certainly they are a sort of almost a rigid residual service. And then there's a municipal provision, and the municipal provision is focused on infectious diseases and on mental health. I'm not going to talk about mental health at all, but it's focused particularly on infectious diseases from the 1870s, so TB, various kinds of sanatoria, dealing with epidemics of things like typhus, and particularly of children's diseases. So in Leeds, you've got one very large voluntary hospital, plus a number of smaller hospitals, including quite a significant maternity hospital by the 1930s. You've got also a significant hospital for women, and this may reflect the fact that Leeds has a large female workforce who contribute strongly to the contributory schemes I'm going to talk about in a minute. So they possibly do actually influence the way in which services are provided there. You know, you've got 250 beds focused on women patients. There's also a public dispensary, which is a small hospital, Jewish hospital, various other small institutions. But really, it's dominated by the general infirmary. On the other hand, you've got poor law institution, St. James's, which is massive. 1,200 beds in it, St. Mary's, Rothwell, and North Lodge, South Lodge, which are all smaller ones, and then you've also got municipal provision for TB and for infectious diseases. The Seacroft Infectious Disease Hospital at 500 beds is very big. You've got a big city, 400,000 people, you need quite a lot of services, but they tend to be concentrated in a few institutions with some kind of like minor ones around. And so you can see that each of these hospitals or these providers are providing for a different sector, for the curable, respectable poor through the voluntary sector, for the infectious through the infectious municipal sector, and then for the others, for the chronically ill, for the elderly, for those who can't or don't have any other kinds of provision in the poor law. And there's a gratuitous picture of some hospitals. It doesn't add really anything to what I'm going to argue, except for the fact that I do like the Brotherton Wing, even though it's out of the day. I think it's fantastic. It's built as a private pay ward at the end of the 1930s, and it looks like a ship, and I think it's a lovely building. The others are just kind of like dull hospital buildings. One of the things that kind of keeps Leeds hospital sector going is that it has a deep, traditional voluntary sector. The middle class in Leeds dates from the 18th century, is very wealthy, is very engaged with the city, families like the Marshalls, the Luptons, the Middletons, the barons are all running these institutions into the 20th century. The barons felt that basically they owned the maternity hospital and would run it as if it was their institution. Charles Lupton was on the board of the LGI for 50 years. These people are very closely engaged with running the hospital on a voluntary basis. And in the later 30s, they're replaced by Sir George Martin, who is also really very, very actively keen voluntarist. And they help to kind of support the funding regimes which each of these hospitals have. So the voluntaries are based upon charitable giving plus voluntary care and management. So the people who run it are mostly there doing it for free. Most of the doctors do it for free. The only people really who are paid in it are the nurses and this kind of the people who care, the carers within the institution. Everybody else is doing it as a voluntary activity. In the case of the other two sectors, they're paid for out of the rates, which means that there's always a downward pressure on their spending because people don't like to pay rates. And so people, particularly the poor law, given that it's often seen as being for the undeserving poor, there's always a downward pressure on the sort of the costs there. There is very little government support. It's tiny. It comes only usually for very specific activities. And this means that they all had to live within their means. Nobody was ever going to bail them out. The ratepayers weren't going to bail them out. Council wasn't going to bail them out. And certainly if they were voluntary and they ran a deficit, they had to cut their cloth. There was nobody going to give them any extra money. We'll come back to that in a minute anyway. There's also, in addition to the kind of traditional middle class elite, there's also a strong mutualist sector. The labor movement in Leeds is not big and strong. It's not like it is in Sheffield with lots and lots of big, strong male worker unions. It's much more diverse and dispersed with lots of weak groups around it. So it tends to focus much more on a mutualist approach, friendly societies, cooperative movements, things like that, rather than the unions. And out of this mutualist system develops the contributory schemes, which we'll talk about in a minute. So before the First World War, the hospital income is largely drawn from the traditional sources. It comes from subscriptions of the wealthy. It comes from donations from the wealthy and from people kind of collecting in various different formats. It comes from a decent slice from investment. They have money in the bank, which they draw down quite a healthy income on before the war. And then they're boosted by a growing contributor element, where workers club together to make small contributions through a thing called the Leeds Workpeople's Hospital Fund, amounting to around 20% of the hospital's income by the First World War. So a significant part of the income is actually coming from this mutualist approach. People get together, collect money for themselves, hand it over to the hospital, and then, as members of that scheme, expect entitlement to treatment. As I mentioned, there's little or no income to the voluntary sector from either the local or the national state. Obviously, the other two sectors were funded from those rates, but they're directly and are directly controlled by elected local authorities. And so they have those parameters set for them. And this is quite important for how things develop differently between France and Britain, that the absence of the state is quite significant here. And of probably greater importance is the fact that in the National Health Insurance Act of 1911, which covered workers for doctor's care and various other forms of healthcare, it does not include hospitals. And this is going to be very significant for the way in which hospitals develop in Britain over the 1920s and why they develop in a different way, I think, to the French. So the mutualist sector becomes much more important in Britain than either the state or of any other kind of format or the council. Now, I have included a picture of Lille or a picture of France, just in case you don't know. And Lille is right there at the top. It's really in Belgium. It's kind of on holiday in France. And, you know, they drink beer. They eat lots of raw meats. They're very, very, very like, much more like the Belgians than the French. So it's very much an industrial city as well. I mean, it's one of, again, one of France's leading industrial sectors. textiles, chemicals, engineering, has a population slightly smaller than Leeds, about 250,000, but it's part of a conurbation which includes Roubaix and Tourcoing. I'm never sure how to say that. Lille is occupies a very similar place in the urban hierarchy to Leeds, an early industrializer with a diverse population. However, unlike Timothy Smith's Lyon, and very important for the difficulties it faced in the 20s, Lille was occupied by the Germans during World War I, for the entire First World War. And this had some major impacts for it. In France, in Lille, the system is slightly different. They have a kind of a unified system I'll talk about in a minute. The Hospice de Lille has two general hospitals, which you can see at the top, both with 400 beds. It has a small private hospital, private wing, on one of those two hospitals. And then the rest of it is made up largely of hospices. Now, hospices can be both hospitals that resemble very much the pool or infirmary in some cases, or in other cases, they're just old people's homes or they're orphanages, and they're dealing with those kind of sectors. So you can see down there that there's although they're called hospices, they're orphanages or they're old people's homes for couples. So they kind of include all kinds of things. So within the funding for the hospital sector, there is also this funding for these other groups. And it's largely historic because they're built on foundations and endowments, sometimes going back to the 13th or 14th century. At the very bottom, you can see there's a Hospice d'Incurables, which is formed it opens in 1907. And that is very like a pool or infirmary, but it also, it's a bit like mental deficiency institutions, which are brought into Britain in 1910 to 12, because it does include that kind of people who can't look after themselves effectively is the key kind of criteria there. And it's funded by a coalition between the council, the department, the government, and the hospitals. And then we have the pictures of them. There's the old Hospice General at the top, one of the kind of the smaller hospice on the left, and then the big new Charité, which is opened in the 1880s. And one wing of that hospital is run by the Free University Medical School, and the other wing is run by the Catholic University. So it's kind of like a very interesting French compromise for the late 19th century, where where the Catholic University has part of the institution and the Free University has the other part. So what makes this system different to start with is that in the 1850s, all of these hospitals and kind of various other institutions are bundled together in one management and funding pot. So the traditional endowments and the traditional income, all these different places, are unified under a single management structure with all the income going into one place. It's quite early that it happens in the 1850s. And they see all the various legacies and endowments are pooled in a single central administration, and some shared facilities are put together. And the administration includes representatives of the medical, the business, and the professional classes. The vice chair is usually a doctor, but there are also other two. And then the chair of the committee is the mayor. So there is this link to the council in this, that the mayor is the chair of the committee that runs the hospitals. You also see other forms of municipal involvement before the First World War. Throughout the 19th century, they are giving subventions to the hospice because they can never make ends meet. Their endowments are insufficient to meet the costs that they have, and so the council tends to step in. Although just at the very end of our period, in the Belle Époque, you do start to see the hospitals breaking even, largely because they're beginning to get some money from the central state system. I'm not sure how important this is, but Lille is a socialist city. It's one of the kind of the bedrocks of French socialism. And the Catholics are relatively weak because there are large numbers of Protestants in the town from Holland, and there are also various other groups. So it's quite a contested place, but it's, unlike Lyon, the Catholics are not the dominant group by any stretch of the imagination. And it's kind of worth recognizing that the financial structure is very, very different. The hospitals depended on income from endowments. Money that they have been collecting for hundreds of years is pulled in the system. It's invested, often in effectively leasehold-type property for 100 years. There are a whole range of different sort of systems for drawing income out of their investments. But there seems to be no way in which the community or the citizens can be involved in this fundraising activity beyond giving a donation or a legacy. There are no ways of fundraising for the system. So it tends to be very much a kind of a closed one in which they have this income and the income is relatively flat. Though after 1893, there is growing state responsibility. So in 1893, there is a thing called, which I'll call AMG, which is for the sick poor. And it basically, it's an insurance scheme for the sick poor. And in 1905, there's another one called which I'll call AO, which is for the elderly. So by the First World War, the state is already beginning to kind of pump money into these systems to cover those groups, which are largely the same ones covered by the poor law in Britain. That leads it, yeah. So this is the nature of the crisis then. There is already a deficit. As you can see, the red line at the top is expenditure, and the blue line at the bottom is income. This looks a lot like my own household expenditure. And you can see that the two rarely meet until the very, very end of the interwar period. So in Leeds, this is specifically the Leeds General Infirmary. It runs at a loss throughout a 30-year period, really, a 20-year period, anyway. But the First World War exacerbates this even more, and you can see that from the spikes that we've got in there. And what I'm going to talk about now briefly is what is it that causes that big divergence of income and expenditure in the early 1920s, and how do they move towards getting back together towards the end. There's a little picture of Charles Lupton looking like his hamster's just died. So there is a shortfall in 1918 already, and that's worsened by rapid inflation. In Britain, inflation in the late 1910s and early 20s is round about 50% over 2 years. It's serious by British standards, although, as we'll see soon, it's not serious Western European standards. So there's rapid inflation in this. Prices rose by more than 50%, pushing up costs whilst devaluing fixed investments. So those fixed incomes that they rely on, they don't go up at the same speed, which means their value declines rapidly. There's a fall in the quantity and the value of subscriptions. So the number of people giving declines a bit, but the amount they give doesn't really change from before the First World War, so it's becoming worth less and less to the hospitals. They couldn't keep up with the rapid rise in costs. Though donations in the early 20s were quite buoyant, people had cash in their pockets because of the inflation, so they tended to give cash rather than subscriptions. Income from government to cover injured and disabled servicemen fell sharply in 1920, whilst the value of investments remained unchanged. And there was also a bit of a windfall from council payments to treat VD. There was a post-war epidemic of STDs, which actually helped the hospital because the council paid for that service. There was also an increase in patients, and you'll find this in France as well. Costs were strained by this increase in the number of patients who were seeking treatment. It's generally regarded that the war encouraged more people to seek hospital treatment and to change their attitude as new drugs, but particularly as new procedures and new organizational structures. Seemed to justify a faith in the more curative potential of hospitals. People become much more keen on a hospital, and they want to go there, whereas before they might have wanted to avoid it. There was also obviously a lack of investment during the war. Hospitals were suffering from that during wartime, and this had to be addressed at the time when costs of construction were high and wage costs were also rising. So the hospitals were facing rising wages. The cost of getting anything built between about 1919 and 1922 was absolutely massive in Britain because there's so much pressure on it. So the costs of doing things were being pushed up in that way. As a result of all these, the Leeds General Infirmary had an overdraft in excess of £100,000 by 1921, whilst the smaller hospitals were similarly stretched. And across the country, voluntary hospitals were under immense pressure, leading to the government's commission, and a general pessimism about the voluntary sector. Indeed, Charles Lupton there even contemplated the possibility that the voluntaries would have to be taken over, and certainly that they would require emergency and possibly long-term government funding. There's a real pessimism in the voluntary sector around 1920-21. They just don't think they're ever going to be able to make this up. And the government, through the Onslow Commission, which I'll talk about in a minute, does come to their rescue a bit. So things were bad in Leeds. Arguably, they were much worse in Lille. There was a loss of income, first of all, by the occupation. The situation in Lille was even worse, where the hospitals had massed enormous debts during the course of the war of over 2 million francs. And this was caused by a number of these factors here, some of which were fairly short-term, others were more enduring. The first and foremost, loss of income through the occupation. This was because much of the income was tied up in property, and for various reasons, tenants didn't pay their rent. It may be that their farm was blown away. Obviously, a bit of a disincentive to pay your rent. For other reasons, they might have just decided that because the Germans were occupying, they wouldn't pay the rent. And this happened quite a lot. Or there was inflation, so they couldn't keep up with the cost of the rent. And there were certainly by 1918 rapidly rising rents, which made it very difficult for people to keep up with them. So there was enormous arrears by the end of the war, and though much of it was recovered, not all of it was. So there was loss there in terms of unpaid rent. In addition to non-payment of rent, there was considerable loss of income through war damage. Though through physical damage to the hospital was quickly recompensed by the government, but the loss of rental properties was more complicated and took some time to settle, even leading to lengthy disputes with the council over what exactly should be covered in that. It's a bit of a technical issue, but basically the council was saying that because these were income generating, they shouldn't pay make them better, to increase their income. It was up to the hospitals to do that. There were also increased costs through the war damage. The cost of some of the repairs did have to be met by the hospitals, whilst the huge demand for men and materials, again, as in Britain, pushed up prices. So this was on top of massive general inflation, denuding the value of their investment. In 1919, it's been calculated inflation was over 100% in Lille. It was higher in the occupied zones than it was in the non-occupied, over 100%. By 1922, prices had increased 4 to 5-fold on 1914. So in terms of investments just can't keep up with that scale of inflation. And they were particularly where they were tied to the price of wheat or to government bonds, which recovered fairly quickly, but others, especially the leasehold type of properties, could not be easily adjusted. And so it's really only in the mid-1920s they're able to adjust that. And also there was increased demand, as there was in Britain, and also the existence of schemes probably encouraged more people who want to use the hospital. You probably can't see that, but basically it just shows that year on year throughout the war, you've got deficit rising from 180,000 francs to around 350,000 francs through most of the other years, so ending up with that 2 million of lost income. It doesn't look as bad as Leeds, but I think that's partly because quite a lot of the lost income is not being shown on this. This is the current account. But there's certainly things are much worse than this figure makes it look. And by the mid-20s, as you can see, they're beginning to lose. A gap is beginning to emerge between income and expenditure from about 1923 onwards, as the government puts pressure on the amount that they're willing to pay for stays in hospital. So how do we respond to this? Well, in Leeds, the response is largely public. It starts off with a straightforward appeal, or a number of appeals. And in Britain, it's fairly common when the Lord Mayor is in office, if something goes wrong, he holds an appeal. And the Lord Mayor held a variety of appeals. So in 1918, the Lord Mayor's appeal gives 27,000. 120,000 in total was raised during 1920 to pay off that wartime overdraft, including a single donation from a man called Joseph Watson of £50,000. They get 35,000 from the National Relief Fund, which is a kind of, I think it's a voluntary collection that's redistributed around the country, and more from the Lord Mayor's Fund. And even as late as 1925, they get another virtually £50,000 from the Lord Mayor's Fund to try and pay off that big deficit we saw. So there's a strong sort of civic mobilization element going on here. And it incorporates both the very wealthy and the ordinary citizen who's willing to give in the street to the Lord Mayor's appeal or to go out and do kind of fundraisers for it. Unusually, exceptionally, I would say, there is also some government support. Following, as a result of the Onslow Commission, the central government made around £1 million available to the voluntary hospitals across the country to support them on a one-off basis as long as they agreed to work together to cut waste and share resources. They did it for that period, and then they stopped doing it, stopped talking to each other again. Only on a temporary, and by the time the money arrived, in most cases, the worst of the crisis was over. It doesn't really arrive until 22, 23, by which time most places had come to some kind of settlement. And then there's no further funding from the central state for voluntary hospitals except for specific activities like radium treatment in the 1930s. So the voluntary hospitals really have to continue to fund themselves, and the central state doesn't pay for them. There are some support from the municipality, from the Leeds Council. The hospitals were able to get money from the council. The law allowed that. This was legally possible, and it was usually given as a grant with no strings, which was in turn deemed acceptable by the voluntary hospitals. Because they were getting a grant, the council wasn't getting any political control over them and weren't buying any control through this money. They were just giving it to them. The council made regular payments for specific categories of patients, as I mentioned, VD, which was equal to about £10,000 per annum in the early 20s. Plus, they seem to have made a one-off payment in 1924, prompting a debate over municipalization versus voluntary control. When the council does give that money, the socialists see it as an opportunity to say, well, instead of just giving them a grant, we should take over the hospitals. And then the voluntarists all come out and say, no, it's a great public good, we'll just keep it going. As it is. But what seems to have made the big difference and kept the hospital running was the work of the Work People's Hospital Fund and their contributors, which despite poor trade and unemployment, usually managed a year-on-year increase across the 1920s and 30s and was giving equal to about 30% of the income of the hospitals, which is actually quite low compared to some other contributory schemes in the Northeast, for example, where they were probably up around 60 or 70%. But it's still a sizable chunk, £40,000-£50,000. It's possible they may have hit a ceiling by 1928, and what happens afterwards is part of the kind of final thoughts. There were still big legacies as well. We have a tendency to think of the 20s and 30s as being an era in which that kind of big voluntary giving stopped. But actually, you can see it throughout the period. There are still big legacies coming in. The Brotherton Wing is called the Brotherton Wing because a guy called Brotherton gives a lot of money towards its building. He also builds the Brotherton Library in Leeds as well. You know, there are still people who are willing to put in large amounts of money to specific activities. I did read, actually, it was going to be called the Lupton Wing because Lupton died, and they were going to call it, and then they obviously changed the name and called it Brotherton. What a poor thing, you know. But none of these were quite enough to halt the mounting deficit by the end of the 20s, and the hospitals ran an annual deficit of around 25,000 per annum, which was approximately 20% of their expenditure. So they were still running throughout the 20s this deficit. There is some argument that hospitals did this on purpose, that it was always good to keep people kind of active by saying, oh, we're on the brink of bankruptcy, so you must keep giving to keep us going. And obviously the banks allowed it to some extent. And then every so often they'd come and they would have a clear out. But whether or not that's what LGI was doing or whether it simply couldn't get the money is a moot point. So the response in Leeds was essentially a voluntarist response. There was some support from the city council, some money on a one-off basis from central government, but the issue of matching income and expenditure lay overwhelmingly with the hospital, its wealthy supporters, and the citizens of Leeds. This is, of course, as you might expect, completely different to the situation in Lyon, where there seems to have been no voluntary community response. It's often suggested that the French don't do voluntary organisations. This is not true. They have a very strong civil society in France, but it tended to be focused away from welfare in its organisational form. And moreover, the Catholic Church, despite attempts by the government to get it out of people's lives, continued to play a very strong role in welfare and healthcare. Indeed, even in socialist Lille, there were still sisters undertaking nursing in a number of the hospices into the 1920s, and indeed the local committee says, well, when asked why one of the hospitals is cheaper to run than another one, they say, well, that's because the sisters do the work in that one. They're not embarrassed by this. And the parishes continue to provide outpatient services staffed by hospital and university doctors. So there is a kind of a separate sector which is almost unnoticed in all of this. We tend to focus on the organizational hospice element of it. But the Catholic Church is still doing a lot. But what it's not doing and what no one is doing is actually involving civic mobilization in terms of the actual funding of the hospitals. So we see from here that there's a kind of a marked shift in income from endowments to state support in the 1920s. Boring bit coming up. Income from investment in general fell from 63 to 35% of income over our period. The income from government bonds fell from 32 to 8% of that, so the biggest loss is actually in government bonds. And patient payments of various types rose from 15 to 33% of income. Some of this is direct individual payment, but a lot of it is actually government patient schemes, government insurance schemes. On top of that, the hospitals also became dependent on a subvention from the city, which was equal to about 8 to 10% of their income. So every year, at the end of the year, when they ran a deficit, they just went to the council and said, can you just pay that off for us? And the council go, okay. Yeah, well, you know. They became dependent on that subvention. They're also involved in various disputes with the city, not surprisingly, and also with the department. So in the early 1920s, there was a debate over the cost of patients, how much they were charging for the day cost of a patient, which was determined what would be paid by the department for state supported patients. There was an attempt to force down costs by the council and by the department, but the effect was only temporary. The hospitals just carried on charging pretty much what they wanted. And they were in some of the cases, they were very, very generous in terms of the hospitals. In terms of the hospice, they tended to be less generous, where they only got meat once a day, whereas in the hospitals you got meat three times a day. So there's kind of like stuff like that. Also in the mid-1920s, there was a dispute over council subvention to meet the deficit. The council claimed that the hospital had been misusing its extraordinary income, and the council said it wouldn't agree a budget for 1926 because the council had to agree the budget. But the hospital said they would close their doors. And the department had to adjudicate and settled in favour of the hospitals, leading to a loan from the council to improve their rental properties. So this is kind of like a small, quite a technical issue, but what it showed was that the hospitals always had that power to be able to say, if you don't support us, we're going to close our doors. And that sort of meant that the relationship with the council was far less obvious than it appeared. And this was repeated at the end of the 1920s when the hospitals were accused of using state money to improve their pay wing. And another adjudication was needed by the department, and the hospice won again. There were a long-running dispute over whether rental property was eligible for war damage reparations. They won that one. So overall, despite apparent oversight authority over the actions of the hospitals, the council and the department actually had little control over what the hospitals did. And it was relatively easy for them to overspend or act largely in their own interests, as the council didn't have the day-to-day management, but would always ensure that the hospitals didn't fail. So even though the mayor is the chair of this committee, he very rarely is able to actually impose any kind of municipal control over what it does. So, do we see some divergent paths? Well, obviously we do. I would argue that in England, the absence of state support left hospitals to find the income from the patients. This was the solution that they looked for. They used prepayment schemes. This was the preferred model in Leeds. And after 1930, there's a shift to an actual contributory scheme, which is more organized and increases the income from the workers by about 50%. And that secured income into the 1930s. And you also see by the end of the 30s that they're also drawing much more on direct payment as well. So Leeds General Infirmary is using both contributory schemes and direct payment. There were some attempts to get the employers to contribute as well, but these tended to fail. And there was often the contrast between Leeds and Sheffield, where Sheffield and the Sheffield employers were very closely involved and did contribute quite extensively, and in Leeds they just kept resisting and saying they did it in other ways. And the major appeals were still capable of finding large sums for specific projects. So there's another one in the early 1930s which raised £250,000, quarter of a million pounds raised from various sources over a kind of 3 to 4 year period in the early 30s. In France, the state became increasingly involved both in local management and in paying for patients. The role of the city council especially is very apparent in the 20s, and there's this tussle over who was to have overall control. And as I said, although the mayor may have chaired the committee of management, he was definitely did not control the running of the hospitals. And they do seem to have been run largely by the doctor, who was the vice chair. After 1928, a national scheme was introduced to provide insurance for the bulk of the population, although it only paid 80% of the cost of the patient. As a similar model to the national insurance in the UK, but it did cover hospital care. And though there were a lot of transfer costs in it, plus a slight shortfall in the payment, it provided a big boost to hospitals at this point and assured their income for the future. It got them away from having to rely on endowment and instead on these bulk payments from the state. However, although the non-state responses were limited, the state never took control of running hospitals. And the Hospice de Lille remained a multi-partner agency, with managerial and financial input from the hospitals, from the council, from the universities, the department, and in the case of service delivery, even the Catholic Church. So it's not just one kind of provider, it's a whole range of different people who are interested. So by the 1940s, one system existed for the delivery of hospital care in Lille with this multi-partner agency system. There were many stakeholders, as evidence in the development of the Centre Hospitalier Régional, which drew on all levels of the state for financing. A big, massive hospital that they were going to build south of Lille. They started planning it in 1930. It wasn't actually opened until 1952 for various different reasons, kind of war and things like that. But it was always a partnership between the central state and all the various different nested levels of government in France, who were all chipping in their bit. The hospitals were public bodies, but they were not state-owned services. I think this is kind of like an important element of it. They had public personality, but they were not run by the state. On the other hand, in the early 40s, in Leeds, two different systems existed, the public and the voluntary. There was some interaction locally, but limited involvement of the state in financing the voluntary sector left them strong and independent in 1945, I would argue. Indeed, the failure to include hospitals and national health insurance in 1911 probably produced the path which led to this strength in 1945, where they had basically had developed their own income streams. And that may have been a stimulus to nationalisation of hospitals in Britain, as the government and the hospital sector together could not agree on how to fund patients yet retain a plural system of delivery, largely because the British system had developed as one predicated on funding institutions, not on funding patients.